Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
We just want to pop your insights,
unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Let's get back to it. The number is 888-914-9149. We've got room for you right now if you want to call in. Let's go to Joseph in Virginia. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning, Patrick. I've got a more of a theological conundrum than a spiritual one, and that is trying to reconcile the preordained determination of Judas Iscariot to betray Jesus with his freedom of choice as a human.
Right. Well, so you're talking about the passages, I'm assuming, where it says that he fulfilled prophecy by being the one to betray Jesus?
Yes. And okay. I guess you can say the same thing regarding Mary as well, given her fiat.
Right.
So it's the freedom of choice. That's the conundrum for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fair enough. So the first thing I would suggest, let's talk about Our Lady first, and that would be that the church does teach the doctrine of predestination, that God predestines those whom he foreknew, and Our Lady would be the prime example of that, where she was not just predestined to be among the blessed in heaven, but she was preserved in grace from the very moment of her conception so that she would. But the mystery here is that she nonetheless still had her free will. And the reason that that must be true, if you think about it this way, is because God creates you and me, creates all of us as human beings out of love. He doesn't need to create us for any reason. He doesn't lack anything. He's not lonely. So when he creates you and me, he does so out of love. And as you know, we are created as human beings, we are created in such a way that we can not only know God's love, but we can respond to God's love. But if we didn't have free will, we could not respond to God's love with love. We could respond with obedience, or, you know, if you're forced to do something, whatever the software program says you're going to do is what you do, and that's not true of human beings. So there's a mysterious interplay between God's drawing that person to himself and the person's free will to accept it, or even just inert, in other words, where the will becomes supine and doesn't choose God, but just simply allows it to happen. That's another little nuance in this bigger question. So we can say with certitude that just as it's true of the Blessed Virgin Mary and those who are predestined for heaven, that their free will is thoroughly engaged and they're not being forced to do anything. The same is true for Judas Iscariot, that when he betrayed the Lord, he did so of his own free will. Now, indeed, it did fulfill prophecy. So the fact that, of course, God knows everything that can be known, so he knows what will happen. But even if as the prophets foretold that this would happen, doesn't mean that Judas somehow was forced into it, that he was not like an unwitting patsy or something like that. He freely did what he did, and that's what made what he did so evil as far as he himself was concerned. So there it is in a nutshell. We can go deeper if you want.
In respect to others who want to get on, no.
No. I have all the time that we need. Joseph, I have all the time that we need.
I just still find myself on the fence with this because, again, with the free will, what strikes me as somewhat ironic, if he did, in fact, exercise his free will not to betray, he'd be, in essence, betraying the very plan of salvation. Right?
Well, in other words, what if it'd be like, what if Jesus had said in the garden, instead of Father, not my will be done, but yours, when he said, let this cup pass from me, Jesus had complete free will. So if we can use that as a parallel, we could say, what if Jesus had said, I don't want to die on the cross? And then the crucifixion would never have happened. And he, you know, and all of human history, of course, would be different from that. And he wouldn't have fulfilled what he was sent to do. This is where there is no real conflict between God's providence and our free will, because God's providence foresees what's going to happen. Not in time, because God's outside of time. So the fact that it was prophesied that Judas would do this and he fulfilled the prophecy thereby doesn't mean in any way that he was somehow hostage to the devil and he was forced into doing something he didn't want to do. And difficult to contemplate, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, therein lies the conundrum. For me.
Yeah, but well, help me understand the conundrum then, because
and,
I don't
and I'm
see
not
it.
Saying, and I'm not, by no means am I saying Judas got a bad rap, because if I mm-hmm. thought that, then I have a spiritual conundrum, and I do not. Mm-hmm. It's just, again, the issue of God's providence determining mm-hmm. in a man who has freedom of choice that his decision is already preordained, but it's his.
Well, see, that word preordained is the problem, I think, because it's, see, I think maybe you're concerned that there is a fatalistic kind of dimension to this. It's not preordained.
Or predestined.
Okay, predestined.
Divinely okay. predestined.
Got it. So please understand, divine predestination does not mean preordained. They sound like the same thing, but they're not really the same thing. So preordained means that it is decreed that you shall do such and such.
Okay.
There's a nuance here, and that is that if something is decreed in that sense and you have no choice but to do what has been preordained, that's fatalism. That's where you're not really responsible for anything, good or bad. Because if you're just in the matrix and you have to do what the preordained program mm-hmm. says you have to do, you're not a free agent. And therefore, you can't be held accountable for anything, because none of it really comes from your free will choices. Predestination is, it sounds very similar, but it's different in this sense, and that is that God is drawing the person who's predestined to heaven, but not forcing the person. And so Mary, to go back to her for a minute, she had complete free will. And her will, of course, was super enhanced and aided by the graces that God gave her from the moment of her conception. But at no point along the way was she forced into doing anything. She, in theory at least, she could have said no, but why would she say no? Because she was so closely attuned to God's will. And I think that's where the distinction lies, is that the more one is cooperating with God's grace, the more easily you will say yes to his will, to the point where you say, 100%, Lord, whatever you want, that's what I want to do. Right. Show me your will that I might do it.
Okay.
Can I recommend a book?
Please.
Excuse me. It's called Predestination by Father Reginald Garrigou Lagrange. Mm-hmm. And he was a Dominican friar, a theologian of great note. And this book, published by Tan Books, is a one-volume overview of this very question. And he gets into the issue of free will and God's sovereignty and divine providence and Judas and those who are predestined for heaven. In all of the above, I realize that maybe we can only scratch the surface here, but if you'd like to go much, much deeper, he can take you there.
No, I think this is fine. It was helpful. I mean, the phrase that when you said God is drawing, that rung a chord with me.
Mm.
So, all right. Well, thank you for your thoughts on my thought.
You're welcome. And I like talking about this topic. Jesus himself talks about those who are drawn by the Father. So John chapter 6, verse 44 might be a passage to meditate upon. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him mm-hmm. up on the last day. Now, you can dig your heels in and say, nope, I'm not going. But mm-hmm. if God is drawing you, then the terminus point will be union with the triune God in heaven for all eternity. But mm-hmm. you would have to say yes to it.
All right. Very good.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your time and your thoughts. Bye-bye.
You got it, Joseph. Thank you. Great topic to think about. No doubt about that. Let's go to Ron now in Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Ron.
Yeah. How you doing, Patrick?
I am not too bad for a sinner. That's the honest truth.
I got a quick question. I was listening to one of the Muslims channels, and they said Alexander the Great started the Catholic Church.
Hmm. That's interesting, because Alexander the Great lived 300 years before the time of Christ.
Yeah, and it's on the Catholic website.
Huh. I bet the owner of that website will be pretty surprised to find that he's saying that the man who started the Catholic Church lived and died 300 years before the time of Jesus. That must have been an amazing trick. No.
Yeah, but that's what they said. That's what they said, too.
Think about that, though, Ron. That'd be like saying that, I don't know, George Washington started your company. George Washington has been dead for not 300 years, but close to it. So it's patently false. It's not Alexander the Great. I think, if I had to guess, that they probably said not Alexander the Great, but the Emperor Constantine. Is that possibly
they said Alexander the Great, because there's a friend of mine. He's real, I guess, one of those woke people and stuff, and he can't wait to find, because I was telling him that I was getting ready to try and be a Catholic, and and then when I told him that, they come out, see, I told you, and I was like, man, shut up. You might got one thing right, but I don't think it's right.
Well, that for sure isn't right, because 300 years is 300 years. Alexander was dead and gone when Jesus died on the cross.
That's also what the internet is saying, too, though. And it does say that it was, because that was the religion at the time of the Romans.
No, because Alexander was Macedonian. So they've got the wrong place, the wrong time, the wrong guy. It's not Alexander the Great. He was dead and gone 300 years by the time Jesus rose from the dead. So I think there's a mistake in translation here. I'm almost certain that they're really referring to the Emperor Constantine, because he was the emperor of the pagan Roman Empire at the time of the church being allowed to come out of the catacombs and no longer be persecuted. And he himself converted to Christianity, and he himself... he's the one who allowed the Catholic Church and even mandated that the Catholic Church would become the state religion. Now, this was taking place in the early 300s. So that's 300 years roughly after the time of Christ. That's 600 years after the time of Alexander the Great. And almost always, if somebody is going to assert that the Catholic Church started with some pagan origin, they pin the tail on the Emperor Constantine in the early 4th century. So I bet you, Ron, if you went back and looked at that website or talked to that guy, he'd probably have to check his notes and say, oh yeah, that's right, not Alexander the Great, but the Emperor Constantine. Now, he didn't start the Catholic Church, and one way you can know that is not only from what the Holy Bible says in the four Gospels about Jesus starting the church at, you know, doing it himself, but also we have a list of the popes of the Catholic Church from the time of St. Peter, who died in the year 64 under the Emperor Nero, all the way to the time of who was Pope when the Emperor Constantine began to turn the Roman Empire now into a Catholic empire as opposed to a pagan empire. We know who all those popes were. And we have a history of the Catholic Church and what was said and what was done in that intervening period of 250 to 300 years. So it would be impossible for the Emperor Constantine to start a church that had already been in existence for nearly 300 years. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay, I thought so. So I'm correct. So
I'm happy to hear that you're on the journey to becoming Catholic, Ron. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like, because I don't know what you just show up someplace and say, hey, I want to be Catholic.
Kind of,
that
yeah.
Was the
so,
other question.
Yeah, here's how you can do that. So in Tampa, what you would do is just, you know, look on, if you have an iPhone, you can do it in Maps. Just look for Catholic churches near me. And then you'll find all the Catholic churches that are in your area. And then go to one and tell the parish priest there that you are interested in finding out more about the Catholic Church. And he will welcome you to join what they call the RCIA program. And that just stands
right,
for...
I heard about that.
You heard about that? Okay. So that's that begins with inquiry classes. And for those who do want to become Catholic, they move through other phases, including what's called becoming a catechumen, somebody who's like formally on the way into the Catholic Church. And then you get all your questions answered, you learn, you prepare, you pray. And then when the time comes, typically it's the Easter Vigil Mass. Typically, that's when people are formally received into the church. And what a great and glorious thing that would be. So you can start that process at your local Catholic parish.
Okay. Appreciate the answer, though.
Yeah, happy to. Yeah. And I'm always here for you, Ron. We're always here for you at Relevant Radio.
Yeah.
So.
And now I can go back and throw it back in his face. I'm like, no, that wasn't true.
You know what you could do? Do this, Ron, if you get the Relevant Radio app on your phone. Just when the archive copy of this show is launched, about an hour after the show is over, you can just send him a link to this part of the show. So you want the first part of the second hour of the show today. And just play it for him. Send him the link, and he can listen to it for himself. And by the way, he can call me if he wants to talk to me about it. I'll be happy to talk to him about it.
Well, he's tried to call you a couple of times and stuff, but I think that they put him on hold, and he's very impatient, so he doesn't stay on long enough.
What's his name? I'll keep an eye out for him.
Just his first name.
Just his first name is all.
Kenrick.
Henrik.
K-E-N-R-I-C-K, yeah.
I will be on the lookout for Kenrick. I promise you that.
Okay.
Hey, great talking to you, Ron.
That's great talking to you, too. Good day.
Okay, bye-bye. If you are interested, ladies and gentlemen, in a book that delves into some of the more wild-eyed claims about the Catholic Church being started by the Emperor Constantine or pagan connections or all of the above, one book that gets into a lot of that stuff is called Catholicism and Fundamentalism, The Attack on quote-unquote Romanism by quote-unquote Bible Christians, authored by Carl Keating. And that book came out in, what was it, 1988, I believe it was. I was working at Catholic Answers at that time. And it's just a really good in-depth book that debunks so many of these kinds of claims and gives you lots of details. It's easy to read. It's fun, interesting, but there's a lot there. So you can use that book to destroy with facts and logic, as they say, some of those wild-eyed claims against the Catholic faith. And for that matter, there are any number of tracts and articles and other such things on the Catholic Answers website. Their website is catholic.com. 888-914-9149. Plenty more ahead, including there's some new, check this out. There's some new archaeological evidence that is corroborating a whole bunch of things that you read in the Bible. And some of these archaeological experts are scratching their heads saying, wow, we knew the Bible said that, but we didn't think it was real. I'll tell you what that's all about right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
All right, that's the sound of this next segment starting here on the Patrick Madrid Show. If you'd like to call, the number is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. So as promised, some interesting tidbits here from the world of archaeology. This is from Study Finds. Biblical stories of military events in the kingdoms of Israel and Judah really did happen, archaeologists show. Biblical stories of military campaigns against the kingdoms of Israel and Judah appear to be more than just legendary stories, according to the latest scientific research. Researchers in Israel say ancient Egyptians, Aramaeans, Assyrians, and Babylonians really waged the battles that are described in the Bible. This team found evidence of these historical events in burnt remains from 21 archaeological sites. The study's authors were able to connect them with the Earth's geomagnetic field at the time. The analysis shows that the army of Hazael, king of Aram Damascus, was responsible for the destruction of several cities. They include Tel Rehov, Tel Zait, Horvat Tevet, and Gath, one of the five Philistine states. By the way, Tel in Hebrew means like a large hill. A lot of the towns in, say, Galilee, for example, are named with the word Tel in it. Tel Aviv, for example. And that's not in Galilee, by the way. Findings also indicate the Edomites razed parts of southern Judah to the ground after taking advantage of the fall of Jerusalem. The study, which is published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, also refutes the theory that Hazael conquered Tel Beth Shean. Based on the similarity or difference in intensity and direction of the magnetic field, we can either corroborate or disprove hypotheses claiming that specific sites were burned during the same military campaign. This is mind-boggling to me, how they can do that. How you would even, oh, well, we just consult the, you know, we just look at the magnetic field of the Earth. Well, how do you do that? Well, these things happened, you know, X number of thousands of years ago, and somehow these scientists have figured out how to do that. They say they've constructed a variation curve of field intensity over time, which can serve as a scientific tool similar to radiocarbon dating. The Earth's ever-changing geomagnetic field is generated by the motion of liquid iron in the outer core of the planet. It shields the planet from dangerous radiation and enables technology to function, from satellites to phone lines and radio programs. Various dating methods have placed the destruction of Gath in the Judean foothills at around 830 BC. However, researchers were unable to verify that Hazael was also responsible for the destruction of a few other cities. Now, it's interesting because they go into some more of the details about things like, what do we know about the Egyptians and what they did, and the various other groups? And what about the temples and things like that? So here's some tidbits from the study. The last days of the kingdom of Judah are widely debated. Some researchers, relying on archaeological evidence, argue that Judah was not completely destroyed by the Babylonians, while Jerusalem and frontier cities in the Judean foothills ceased to exist. Other towns in the Negev desert, the southern Judean mountains, and the southern Judean foothills remained almost unaffected. Now, the magnetic results support this hypothesis, indicating that the Babylonians were not solely responsible for Judah's ultimate demise. All of these things, of which, of course, are explained and recounted in the Bible. And now, using these very interesting and sophisticated scientific methods and instruments, archaeology is saying, guess what? That stuff really did happen. And we have the science to prove it. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Tom now in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Tom.
Morning, Patrick.
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Oh, so my question is about All Saints Day.
Okay.
And a catechumen had asked me, how can the Pope make like All Saints Day or some other holy day of obligation, because if you don't subscribe to it as going to Mass, then it becomes a sin for you. So his little nuance was the Pope is creating the possibility of sin. I'm sorry about the background. I'm stopping.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What's your thoughts on that?
That's a fair question. I kind of think he's looking at the telescope through the wrong end, but you could say this, say, Jesus said to the apostles in Matthew 18, he said it to Simon Peter individually. He's the very first pope. This is in Matthew 16, 18, but he repeated it to all the apostles as a group in Matthew 18, 18. But let's talk about the pope. So he says to Peter, upon this rock, first of all, you are rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and I will give to you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. And he says the same words, although corporately now, to all the apostles in Matthew 18, 18. So that's the first reason right there is Jesus said, you guys are going to have the authority to make certain things binding on the church, and you can also loose people from things in the church. And then he says in Luke 10, 16, to these same 12 men, he says, he who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. And in Matthew 28, verses 19 and 20, in the Great Commission, he says to go into the whole world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. So we can see those are just four verses right there, but there are others that amply demonstrate that the Lord gave the apostles a juridical authority. Their job was not merely to preach and teach, but also to govern and to bind and loose. And so when the successors of the apostles, and most importantly, when a pope says, okay, guys, we're going to have a holy day of obligation, and unless you're excused because of some extenuating circumstance like illness or a sick baby or something like that, you have to be at Mass on this day. He's exercising this right that the Lord gave him to bind and loose. So if your friend doesn't like that, well, then I would say then ponder Luke 10, 16. He who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. Because in his, I don't know, stubbornness, arrogance, who knows what's driving it, if he says, well, I don't want to do that. All right, well, then if you say I'm not going to do that, and you know that, you know, the church has this authority to bind and loose, and you just flout that, well, you're rejecting Jesus. Do you really want to do that? That's what makes it a serious sin. It's like not eating meat on Friday. Sometimes people would roll their eyes back before the church relaxed this discipline and said you can substitute not eating meat on Friday for some other penance, but nobody really does that. And people will eat meat on Friday throughout the year anyway, just because, well, nobody makes a big deal of that. But let's just back the tape up a little bit to before Vatican II, when it was no meat on Friday. And if you willingly, intentionally ate meat on Friday, that was a mortal sin. And sometimes people roll their eyes and you're saying, oh, come on, are you saying that because somebody ate meat on a Friday, he's going to go to hell? Well, what I'm saying is, what the church says is, if you commit a mortal sin, whatever it is, whatever type, doesn't really matter what the species is. If you commit a mortal sin, which is a willful rejection of God's will or a willful rejection of the church's authority, which is something that the Lord himself expressed, and you die in that state of unrepentance, yeah, you'll go to hell. And eating meat on Friday intentionally when that was still emphasized the way it was, that would be one of those examples. Not going to Mass on Sunday. So the mortal sin lies in the intentional rejection of something that the church says, you need to do this for your own benefit. This is good for you. This is helpful. And we're a family, and we're all going to have dinner on this day. We're all going to sit at the table and have dinner together, and we want you to be there. And if you say, no, sorry, I'm not going to do that, why not? Well, because I don't accept your authority. You're imposing a rule on me that I don't like. Yeah, that's where the mortal sin lies. So I don't know if your friend is ignorant or obstinate or what, but you know, he has to deal with what Jesus himself said as opposed to what he would like it to be. So what do you think, Joe? You know what? I apologize. I think maybe our caller dropped. Yeah, I think he dropped. No wonder I didn't hear back from him. So anyway, those are some thoughts. You know what? I don't know. Where did Joe go? I'm not sure. All right. Well, yeah, it looks like he dropped. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Melissa now in Milwaukee. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi there.
So my question is, I have a sister and brother-in-law who are Lutheran. I converted to Catholicism in 2018. And my
welcome home.
First niece and nephew, thank you, I love it here. So my first niece and nephew were both, my brother-in-law baptized them at home. No one was consulted or invited. Mm-hmm. I've broached the subject with my sister numerous times, and I even prayed a 54-day rosary novena for it. And since listening to your show, I've also learned, though, that if you have been validly baptized, that to be baptized again would be, like blasphemous or not good. So I'm wondering, am I wrong to think that my brother-in-law baptizing them both at home? Now, they have a third child who just was baptized in the church. Okay. But my niece and nephew don't know that they didn't have a real baptism. They've been at their cousin's Catholic baptism. Mm-hmm. So it's just this thing that makes me worried and also uncomfortable.
Okay, I think we can sort this out. So the first thing I need to just get clear in my mind is we're talking about Lutheran folk, right? These are not Catholics?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And did he use the valid formula, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, as he was either immersing the child in water or pouring water over the child's head?
I hope so. I don't fully know. I think so. I can definitely ask my sister again.
That would be good.
But
so the reason I ask that question is, if he used the valid form and matter, so that's the valid form, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and he used valid matter, which is water, not lemonade or something else, but water, and he spoke those words as he baptized the child with water and intended to baptize, then it's a valid baptism. And so there's no way for them to be rebaptized if it was valid. Now, the question really is, was it a valid baptism? And asking those questions will help you ascertain that. Now, it's sad because there's so much more for people who are baptized. And in the church, we have the sacraments of initiation mm-hmm. that include confirmation and the Holy Eucharist, not to mention other sacraments. So these children, nonetheless, though, if they were validly baptized, then they're good to go in that sense. But hopefully, when your brother and sister, was it a sister-in-law or brother-in-law?
Brother-in-law.
Okay. So perhaps in due course, they will follow you into the Catholic Church, and then those children can receive the rest of their sacramental life. But in the meantime, if they're validly baptized, that's a good thing. So there's really nothing more you can do. Now, one downside is that there's no record of their baptism, and this is why baptism should be carried out in the church by a priest. It could be a deacon, but by a priest. Mm-hmm. And the reason mm-hmm. is so that there's a baptismal record. So you have witnesses who are there who saw it, and they know that it was done, and they know that it was done correctly. And there's a paper record, so that in the future, when it comes time to get confirmed or to receive First Holy Communion or to get married or to be ordained a priest,
right,
they have to have some verification that the baptism actually took place, because you can't receive any other sacraments if you haven't first been baptized. So that's why that record
right, and I thought,
is so important.
What if they marry a Catholic someday, you know, because yeah. I had a Lutheran baptism, but I was able to show the record,
right,
you know.
No, that's exactly
well,
right.
Well, that makes me feel better,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, still some kind of problematic aspects, I guess.
Well, maybe if you're interested, for Christmas, you can get them a book by Tim Drake. It's called There We Stood, Here We Stand, and it's a collection of mm-hmm. conversion testimonies by former Lutheran ministers who became Catholic. And they're from various Lutheran synods, Missouri Synod, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, various synods, and I think there might even be a few lay people in there, but primarily, predominantly, they're Lutheran ministers, and they lay it out. Here's why we became Catholic. And if they're believing Lutherans, I think that book might open their eyes, give them some food for thought.
I could hope so.
Yeah.
I also ordered a copy of your book, Inquisition, to their house, so.
Good. One wonders what Lutheran readers of that book might think, but I hope they enjoy it. Hope they get a few laughs out of it.
I hope so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Patrick.
Yeah. Thank you, Melissa. Good talking to you. Maybe we'll take a break. No, we will take a break. We'll take a break right now, and we'll come back straight to your phone calls. You may remember I was talking about when I was a kid back in the 60s, and there was all the, you know, the every year with Halloween, there was a scare about razor blades and candy apples and things of that nature. And it seemed like it most of the time was just a wives' tale. There's a new scare out now. And this is from the Washington Times. I'll tell you what that is. As your children are preparing to go trick-or-treating, you should know about this. I don't know if it's real, but it's in the Washington Times, and I'll tell you what that is with regard to Halloween candy when we come back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio. I see the bad
moon rising. Okay, I'm thinking this through. I'm thinking, oh, Halloween. That's what you're talking about, right?
Well, you just said you're going to tell us all about these dangerous Halloween candies that we all got to watch out for.
There's a bathroom on the right. Isn't that what he's saying?
No comment.
When I was in school, I knew a girl, because when this song was on the radio, when it was popular back in the early 70s, and she would always sing the song as "There's a Bathroom on the Right." And I had to explain it to her. Like, I was all of 10 or 11 years old. And I said, "That's not what he's saying." She said, "That's what he's saying." I said, "That's not what he's saying. There's a bad moon on the rise." And she blushed because she said, "I always thought he was saying there's a bathroom on the right." Is your life improved by knowing that, Cyrus? Is that?
I'm biting my tongue from all of the terrible jokes that want to escape my mouth right now.
Oh, but guess what? I know it's your birthday.
What?
Cyrus Simcoe, no, that today is your birthday. I know that.
Okay.
A little birdie named Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Tweeted that in my ear.
Oh, that's nice of her.
Cyrus Simcoe, take a bow.
Thank
Happy
you.
Happy birthday. Birthday boy.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you.
No.
Happy
birthday. Oh, look what I can do. Look, everybody, I can turn off Patrick. Just like he's singing right now, but no one can hear him.
Cyrus.
See?
to you.
Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate it.
You got it, man.
Yeah, you're the
That's my gift to you.
You're the best.
You love being outed on national radio.
Love it.
Happy birthday.
So I'm expecting the floodgates of birthday greetings to come to you on Twitter and in assorted avenues.
Made it an hour and 45 minutes into the show, and I thought I was going to get away.
I was trying to lull you into thinking that nothing would happen.
I thought we were going to talk about Halloween candy.
When you least expect it. Or something like that.
So about this Halloween candy.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get to that. I'm not done with you yet. I was hearing a sermon, and the priest said, I have to remember it. Maybe I'll do it at the break because I don't want to flub it. That's okay. Happy birthday, Cyrus. Did I mention everybody that it's Cyrus Simcoe's birthday? Do you want to share your age with us, Cyrus?
It's your birthday.
Nope.
All right. Any special plans? Any special meals tonight?
Yeah, the Melanie always makes me whatever I want, and so I've got a special meal planned, and just
tacos?
Hanging out with the kids. Tacos, of course. Gotta be tacos. Oh, it is Mexican.
Good for you.
It is Mexican food. Maybe not
good
tacos.
Good for you. And you're not eligible for AARP yet. I know that. You haven't reached that point in life. But happy birthday.
Thank you, sir.
Well done. Okay, so you ready for the Halloween candy thing?
Yes, please.
You're desperately trying to get off this topic. Okay, Washington Times. Congressional Republicans demand answers from Homeland Security Wednesday over growing fears of rainbow fentanyl just before Halloween. Top members of the House Oversight and Reform Committee doubted whether the Biden administration has taken the new drug threat seriously enough, pointing to the southern border where most of the brightly colored fentanyl pills are entering the U.S. Representative James Comer of Kentucky, a ranking Republican, and Michael Cloud of Texas, who's on the Economic and Consumer Policy Subcommittee, said they want answers on what the Department of Homeland Security is doing to block fentanyl pills from reaching children, in particular to prevent them from being confused for Halloween candy. Fentanyl is the number one killer of young Americans. Given our problems with the open border, etc., that has emboldened criminal cartels to target American children in their drug trafficking operations, As Halloween approaches, it is more important than ever before to be wary of what our children are consuming and be on the lookout for any suspicious candy. The Washington Times contacted the Department of Homeland Security for comment. This letter from these two politicians comes days after the government released final border numbers for fiscal 2022. They showed a shocking increase in fentanyl pouring over the southern border in recent months, with more than 2,000 pounds of it per month. That's double the rate of 2021 and five times the rate of 2020. Border analysts say the more that's seized, the more that's getting through. Another sign of the chaos is the growing size of each shipment of fentanyl. In September of 2021, the average fentanyl shipment that Customs and Border Protection agents detected was 5.7 pounds. Now it's three times that amount. Homeland Security data doesn't break down how much of that is rainbow fentanyl, the brightly colored form of the deadly synthetic opioid that authorities are worried about. Officials say that those colors are designed specifically to entice a younger clientele. Republicans tie fentanyl to the border chaos in several ways. They say the same cartels that control the migrant smuggling routes also run the drugs across the border. Border experts also say the massive amounts of cash that the cartels are pocketing from the migrant smuggling part of it is being trumped into, being pumped into the drug trade, allowing cartels to purchase more precursor chemicals to produce more fentanyl. So that's the answer. Public health experts have tamped down on worries about rainbow fentanyl at Halloween. Some say that this is not based in fact. I hope not, but sure don't want my kids eating fentanyl or anyone else for that matter. So if you're interested in that article, Cyrus will post it for you on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. And you can also access it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go now to Bill in Helena, Montana. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Patrick. Happy birthday, Cyrus.
Indeed. Thank you. Cyrus
Thank
is
you.
Blushing.
Well, I have two questions. The first is, this came up just in the oddest context, really. RCIA, there's a friend of mine. We're actually discerning marriage. She's not Catholic. But she's at a parish in Southern California that's close to her and has been kind of exploring the faith there. And come to find out, as she's looking into RCIA, they charge money for RCIA there, which I thought was very unusual. Mm-hmm. And then the second question is, can you recommend an edition of the Roman Missal?
On that one, probably not. The Roman Missal is something that's produced by various publishers. You might want to try, check in with Angelico Press. I think they have a good one. You can check in also with St. Benedict Press in Charlotte and see what they've got. If they don't have one, maybe try the Catholic Book Publishing Company. But I don't really have lots of detailed information on that. So as for the RCIA charging money, for those who are listening who don't know what that is, RCIA, Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults, it's a process that involves, among other things, learning about the Catholic faith to determine whether or not you want to become Catholic. And if you do, then you would move into, more formally, the rite of Christian initiation for adults, where you become candidates and then catechumens, and then eventually you are formally inducted, you're formally welcomed, I should say, or received into the Catholic Church. So, to my mind, Bill, I don't think that charging money for that is at all appropriate, only because it smacks of simony, it smacks of making a buck off the gospel. And even if there are overhead costs that involve, you know, maybe paying teachers, although typically in most parishes, that's done as a matter of volunteer work. So people who are teaching in the RCIA program in most parishes that I've ever seen are not getting paid anything. It's different from like a choir director or somebody who might have a paid position on staff. But in any case, far better that the parish should find the way to pay people for doing jobs like that out of the parish budget without charging people who want to come and find out, do I want to become a Catholic? I just don't think that that is suitable or appropriate. There may be some fiscal reasons why that might be something that they want to do, and I could understand that, but do it in a different way. You know, be legally, obviously, creative in the way you find funds to do that. But if I were to approach a parish and say, I'm interested in becoming Catholic, and they said, well, that'll be $50, please. For what? Well, I mean, if you want us to tell you how to become Catholic, you have to sign on the line, which is dotted, and pay a fee for that. Well, I'd probably turn around and walk away. And I don't know whether or not that's what's going on in that parish, but it seems from a pastoral standpoint and even just a PR standpoint, how do people outside the church look at that? You're charging me to find out if I want to become a Catholic? I just don't think that would work very well, if at all. So that's my in-the-moment reaction, Bill, to what you asked me.
Well, and that's exactly the conclusion I drew, and that my friend drew. She's like, really? You want to charge me money to explore the Catholic faith? So
yeah.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's not a good idea. And maybe it's, you know, whoever's running the books in that parish who's just thinking bottom line, bottom line, bottom line, I've got to cover all the costs. Understandable, but there are many better ways to go about doing it. This would, I would say, would border, I don't know if it would cross the line into it, but it seems like it would border on the line of scandal, because you're causing someone to stumble in his desire to approach Jesus, to approach the church, to approach the sacraments. And if you're creating a stumbling block in the form of a fee or a surcharge that person has to pay out of pocket, that's really not good. Anyway, let's just hope that's a very localized situation. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Joe now in Old Bridge, New Jersey. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for your show.
Sure.
I had a question, two questions. One was on predestination in terms of dating. And I've heard, talking to my friends, people mention the person that God has set aside for me.
Yeah.
I understand people pray for their spouses, but that kind of like stuck out in my head, and I wanted to see how I could respond to that without kind of just in charity, I guess.
Yeah. This is an interesting question that comes up from time to time, Joe. Is there one person that is by God's decree or by his predestination, his providence, that person and only that person is for you? I don't personally know. I'm not sure whether that's true or not. I think it could be possible for some people and not others. But my instinct is to say that that's not true. My instinct is to say that you could, in theory at least, be happily married to any number of people. And so if in God's providence, the one that you do marry is the one that you marry, well, okay, you sought God's will, and this is how it seemed to you, and you get married, and you make a go of it. You do the best you can. Sometimes people fall in love. This happens maybe quite a bit. People fall in love, and they think, this is it. This is my soulmate. This is the one for me, only to find out maybe a few years into it, this person is hell on wheels. And I can't live with this person. I mean, sad to say. So I don't think that this idea of you've got a soulmate waiting for you out there and it's only that one person, I don't think that's necessarily true. So what do you do? The thing to do is seek to cooperate with God's providence. And that's his unfolding plan for your happiness that involves many things that won't make you happy, things that are difficult or painful, etc. But by seeking to do God's will, Lord, is this the woman you want me to marry? Please show me. And if you feel satisfied based upon what God is showing you, that this is the one, then you go forward in faith and you get married and you give it your all. Recognizing that it may be a difficult marriage, or it may be a marriage without children, or there may be tragedy. Who knows what could happen? But if you're seeking to do God's will and you feel confirmed, sufficiently confirmed, that this is the person, then step forward. That'd be my advice. That's the advice I've given to my children.
Yeah, thank you, Patrick. It sounds good to me. It definitely takes into consideration both parties' free will and inviting God into the marriage. So that makes
absolutely
sense.
You know, maybe a book to read, if you haven't read it already, is called Three to Get Married by the late, great Archbishop Fulton Sheen. Three to Get Married. Okay. So you've got the husband and the wife, and the third person, of course, is the Lord. And if you've got these three personages present and accounted for in a Catholic wedding, then the chances of it being a good, happy, holy wedding, or marriage rather, go through the roof. But if God is left out of it, not so much.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Joe. By the way, are you looking for your spouse? Have you found her? Are you married, or are you on the prowl, so to speak?
I'm on the course of dating. I helped my older brother find his, and now I'm the last man on the boat here, but discerning that. And
have you found anybody of interest yet?
I have. So I'm dating them now, and we'll see where that leads, putting it in God's hands, Patrick.
Good. Well, I will pray that it's a happy outcome for both of you. And when you say them, I think you mean she, right? Her?
That's right. Okay. That's right.
Checking.
One person.
Just checking. You never can tell these days. Well, my sincerest best wishes to you, Joe. I hope that things work out beautifully for you. And I can say that the vocation of marriage is a wonderful, beautiful thing, and I would never change anything. So glad that I married the woman that I married. And I'm so glad she was willing to marry me, that's for sure. But just seek God's will. And as Jesus said, ask and it shall be given to you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and the door shall be opened to you. I'll be right back.
You're doing great, Pat. Just one more hour left, kid.